dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In the course of, well, I guess the better part of 40 years, there are a few people whose intelligence I have had a chance to both benefit from professionally and enjoy as a very close personal friend, than that of Robert Joseph. He and I served together in the Reagan Defense Department a lifetime ago. He went on to accomplish great things in a variety of capacities in successive administrations. And we'll talk a bit about some of his experiences in the course of this full hour of conversation. But just to give you some of the highlights of them, he served as the representative for the Defense Department and the United States government to something called the Standing Consultative Commission, attaining the rank of ambassador for that. This was a mechanism used to monitor compliance with various arms control agreements between the then Soviet Union and the United States. He was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense. He moved on to serve ultimately as an undersecretary of the State Department for Arms Control and International Security. Along the way, he held senior positions in the National Security Council as well. And I think it's fair to say has a track record of public service that is, if not without parallel, certainly it is extraordinary. And I'm very pleased to say that in the course of much of that time, we've worked together and collaborated and made common cause for the national security interests of the United States, and it's a great pleasure to have him with us. Mr. Secretary, thank you so much for joining us and for taking a full hour of your time to visit about some of the critical issues we're currently facing, as well as some of your own personal experiences in the past. Bob, I want to start with sort of reminiscences, I guess, perhaps, of a lifetime of, as I say, service to your country in senior positions in several different agencies of the government. It's given you a vantage point not only to talk about, you know, from whence we have come, but also to perhaps give me a critical assessment of where we are now. In light of your own time in government, is this particular moment one that is sort of symptomatic of how government operates, or is it in some way distinctive, perhaps most especially because of the profound resistance that the President of the United States seems to have pretty consistently encountered from people who nominally work for him in the government? Is that really different from what you've experienced in the past?
I don't believe it's different, but I think it is much deeper today than it has been in the past. And I think that's a reflection of the divisions within our society. But I have seen over the course of a long career, the resistance that the bureaucracy, some call it the deep state, can engender to overcome the desires of those in the White House, those who have a different vision from that of the traditional sort of approach to national security. I think it is, as I said, deeper today and much more vicious, if you will.
That certainly seems to be the case, and I guess that's consistent with my own experience, too. It's not been mostly inside government, as yours has been, but it's been certainly observing it close at hand. And as you reflect on it, Bob, the degree to which it perhaps is a function of the success of people who are of a certain political persuasion, shall we say, in being sort of made part of the permanent bureaucracy, I was struck by the data that I had somebody tell me about recently, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think it was something on the order of 3,000 senior executive service positions were created and filled by the Obama-Biden administration, which, again, having served at that level in your career, you know the importance of those positions to sort of how the government runs, what the lower levels of the bureaucracy do, and what is passed along to the political appointees who sort of sit on top of all of that. Could you talk a little bit about the implications of, well, it's called, I think, burrowing in to the bureaucracy and how that has perhaps contributed to what you just described?
Well, I think it is a fact that in democratic administrations, there is much more burrowing in, as you say, particularly in the latter stages of the administrations. I've seen that over the course of my career, and I was a civil servant observing this throughout a number of different administrations. I think the effect on policy can be significant. I'll give you one example. When I was asked to join the NSC staff as a senior director and special assistant to the president, one of my first tasks was to work on engineering our exit from the ABM treaty, the one that prevented the United States from developing and deploying defenses against missile attack on our country. That had been a treaty that had basically guided strategic thinking and policy and capability, or the lack of capability in this case, for several decades. President Bush, who I served, wanted to exit the treaty. And let me tell you, as the point person in working that exit, I encountered enormous resistance within the government. Resistance within the State Department, which one could say was anticipated, but also within the Defense Department and other agencies associated with national security. In effect, what we had to do was cut out those bureaucracies from the process because of the resistance. We ultimately prevailed, but believe me, that resistance still exists. And there's still a longing because the individuals carry on much further. The individuals in government and civil service positions carry on much further than any particular administration.
The permanent bureaucracy is called that for a reason. Bob Joseph, we have to pause for just a second. We'll be right back with much more on arms control and on the national security interests of the United States and the various threats we're currently facing and why, among other things, we do need effective missile defenses to deal with them. We'll be right back with former Undersecretary of State Robert Joseph on those topics and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour with former Undersecretary of State Robert Joseph. He is, among other things these days, a senior fellow of a terrific organization, the National Institute for Public Policy. He is also a professor at Missouri State University in the tradition of William Van Cleve, an extraordinarily important program there on defense and strategic studies that has produced, well, hundreds, if not more, distinguished graduates who, like Bob Joseph, have performed important roles in government as well as in the public policy arena more generally. Bob, I had to truncate your remarks there to finish up that break at a hard stop, but finish what you were saying about the difficulty that you encountered and our government is still encountering, really, getting full advantage taken of the fact that we no longer are prevented from having comprehensive and effective missile defenses by an obsolete treaty with a country that no longer exists.
Let me just elaborate a little bit on the effects that I witnessed. And I think it might be best to say that in October of 2004, we were successful in deploying what we call a rudimentary capability against the North Korean ballistic missile threat, a rudimentary capability to protect our nation, our population from missile attack, from ICBM-class missiles. That was 16 years ago. Today, we have a rudimentary capability to protect the United States against a North Korean ballistic missile attack. And I would argue that that rudimentary capability is less capable today than it was in terms relative to the threat, because the threat has progressed much faster than our capability in terms of defending against it. And this is not because of a lack of funding. It's not because we don't have the capability in terms of developing the technology. This is the consequence of a entrenched bureaucracy, as well as, in this case, I would argue, the lack of leadership. The lack of leadership across 16 years of both Republican and Democrat administrations. Now, one expects that for the Democrats when it comes to missile defense, because they've always been against protecting the United States against missile attack, despite some of the talking points that you may have heard. Okay, it's all about the ABM treaty. It's all about nuclear deterrence. It's all about what they call strategic stability. And this hoax, this myth that if you deploy missile defenses, there will be an offensive arms race, which has been disproven time and time again. But nevertheless, that lingers. But the Republican administrations, including the Trump administration, has also dropped the ball on this. And without presidential direction, without presidential involvement, we will never get to where we need to be. And that is moving beyond ground-based interceptors to space-based capability, not just sensors, but interceptors in space, killers in space, whether it be directed energy or some other means. Without that leadership, we won't get there, because without that leadership, we won't be able to overcome the entrenched bureaucracies. And again, it's not just the State Department. It's also some of the other institutions that you wouldn't suspect would be part of this, but that clearly are. And my friend, that includes many of those in the services and Department of Defense.
You know, Bob, this is shocking, I'm sure, to most of our audience to hear this. I remember back in the run-up to the election of George W. Bush being involved in a concerted effort, as I think were you, in making the case to the American people that we needed a missile defense, a real missile defense, a capable missile defense, not just against, you know, North Korea or Iran, but against particularly then the Soviet Union and the Russians. And what we found was that most Americans found this somewhat incredible, because they assumed we had a missile defense. It just never occurred to them that they would be left defenseless under the theory that the more complete was our vulnerability to missile attack, the more secure we were actually going to be, which was kind of the central thesis, of course, of the ABM treaty, as you know so well. So when you hear, you know, this kind of comment from somebody who knows his business, like Bob Joseph does, folks, take this to the bank. This is a considerable and persistent vulnerability, despite, Bob, what the president, you know, has directed, as I recall, both in his national security strategy and then in this missile defense review that was done. Wasn't it laid out there, and hasn't there, in fact, been congressional direction as well, that we're to have an actual effective missile defense, including space, against all comers?
I found it not ironic but I found it interesting that the president went to the Pentagon to introduce to the world, to the nation, the Missile Defense Review, the findings and the recommendations of the Missile Defense Review. This is in 2018. The president said all the right things that I would consider to be the right things, that we are going to defend against any ballistic missile defense, any ballistic missile attack against our nation. But that's not what was in the review. And that's not what has happened in terms of the programs. In fact, if you look at where we are today with the cancellation of particular capabilities, and here I'm talking about, you know, the ARC, I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but the RKV that was to be on top of some of the ground-based interceptors. What the president can say that he's done in the last 4 years is dig 20 empty holes. He got 20 silos and nothing to go in them. And now we have this notion of the next generation interceptor, which is 10 years away. Do you think the threat is going to wait until we have the next interceptor? And let me tell you, the next interceptor is not likely to become real in the future just because of the political dynamics. And yet there's hardly any spending on the capability that we truly need. And again, it's lack of leadership. The president can't just say one day that we're going to do this and we're going to do this. And again, he said all the right things. He's got to follow through. There's got to be somebody that follows through and ensures that what the president wants is implemented. And you don't have that today.
Bob, let me just talk about one piece of this, which, you know, brings us basically to the threats of the moment, notably from Russia and China. And that is the missile threats that these countries are now putting into place. We can talk about North Korea and Iran, we will in a moment, but these are the front line menacing dangers that we're confronting. And in addition to their numbers of weapons being vastly in excess of what this limited capability could contend with, they're also making them deliverable by hypersonic and maneuvering weapons against which these defenses we have, such as they are wholly inadequate. The disconnect here is profound, and it goes back to the question that we started with, which is, how can this government be so seemingly indifferent to the sort of direction that it's getting? And I get the point that the president needs to stay on it and provide leadership and so on. But to what extent is this a function of insubordinate subordinates that are not carrying out the direction purposefully, even though they're not in the deep state bureaucracy, they're political appointees of this president?
I think you've done a good job describing a good part of the problem, right? There's no accountability. And look, the president can't, you know, be the manager in the point of contact for ensuring implementation of his vision of missile defense. But there's no one that I have identified at the White House who can even spell missile defense. Okay? No one's following through. And again, it's lack of leadership coupled with a bureaucracy that does what the bureaucracy wants to do.
And knows that it can wait out the politicals such as they are that have a different agenda in mind. So, Bob, just to spend a minute talking about, as we almost did a break, but how serious is this hypersonic and maneuvering missile threat as you see it?
Well, I think it's extremely serious, and that's why we find our adversaries, Russia, China, and now other countries as well, putting a lot of resources into developing, and Russia is now beginning to deploy intercontinental range hypersonic capabilities. And as you say, we have no defense against them. We are working to develop a sensor capability that will allow us to watch the incoming hypersonics. But we not only don't have that capability yet, we don't have anything to stop it once we see it.
One of the reasons, and we can talk about this further on the other side of a break, I have been particularly keen on technology that I've been aware of for, I don't know, the better part of 20 years now, that involves a predictive algorithm, is that it may allow even the relatively modest missile defense systems that we have to address these evolving and now emerging threats by enabling, as the great hockey player Wayne Gretzky used to say, the difference between a good hockey player and a great one is a good one skates to the puck and the other skates to where the puck is going to be. The predictive algorithm gives you the Wayne Gretzky option on missile defense, and I pray to God we're going to get on this because I believe this is essential to protecting our country against the emerging threats. Bob Joseph, when we come back, we're going to talk about some of your experiences in making real arms control happen and the insights that that should give us on the other approaches that people are constantly pushing upon us. That and much more with former Undersecretary of State Robert Joseph. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back with now professor, but also ambassador, Robert Joseph. He served in, among other capacities, the role of Undersecretary of State for Arms Control and International Security during the George W. Bush administration. Bob, there's so much to talk with you about, but one of the things that I know you had as a very significant accomplishment in your storied career and also as a really imprinting experience for you, I think, and for others of us, was the role that you played in disarming Muammar Gaddafi of his nuclear weapons program back before the Obama administration decided to eliminate him. As Hillary Clinton famously said, we saw, we came, and we killed, or something to that effect. A man who we had worked with closely during the period that you were in government at the State Department, as I recall. Tell us about what was the lead up to that disarmament initiative and what you learned from the experience.
Frank, I think I would first say that the success in terms of non-proliferation with Libya was an intelligence success story. I played the role of negotiating with the Libyans in secret negotiations that led to their agreement that we would come over to Libya and literally pick up and put on a large ship hundreds of metric tons of equipment and material up from their nuclear program, everything associated with their nuclear program, and also, by the way, their long-range ballistic missiles. And we actually brought those back to the United States. Why were we successful? Well, in part, we were successful. In large part, we were successful because of exceptional intelligence statecraft, and also because at this point, and this is 2003, we were successful in defeating Saddam Hussein's army, and clearly Muammar Gaddafi did not want to be the next Saddam Hussein.
And you skillfully impressed upon him that that was a distinct possibility, as I recall, did you not?
We certainly did. And events of the day certainly assisted us in doing that. The negotiations that I headed were in London, December of 2003, 3 days before that Saddam was pulled from his spider hole. And I think many in your audience will remember those images, which undoubtedly weighed heavily on Mr. Gaddafi. We were successful also because the negotiations were in secret. And this goes back to your previous discussion, Frank. We cut out the bureaucracy. When I say secret negotiations, I mean, I went along with the intelligence people. I headed the negotiations. There was nobody from the State Department. In fact, the State Department didn't know about the negotiations. There was nobody from the Defense Department because the Defense Department, and this includes at the secretary level, they didn't know about the negotiations. We had to cut them out because we knew we would be undercut by the permanent bureaucracy. It would be leaked, and if leaked, Gaddafi would be in a much more difficult position. that just goes to our earlier conversation. But let me say what the Libya model is. You mentioned that. What we did is we in exchange for Gaddafi abandoning everything, removing it to our country, allowing us to have whatever verification and monitoring we needed after that. In exchange, we provided them with political legitimacy, with access to technology, particularly technology for oil extraction and exploration. We did trade off things for the weapons program, for the nuclear weapons program, and for the destruction of their chemical weapons. We did create a model that was different from Iraq, that if you give up all your stuff, if you make that strategic decision to give it all up and you actually do it, your country will benefit. And that was the Libya model that John Bolton talked about when he talked about applying it to North Korea. 8 years after 2003, in 2011, under a different administration, President Obama, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, they intervene in Libya. Gaddafi ends up dead, and that creates a second model. You give up your WMD, and you get dead in a ditch. And of course, that's the model that the North Koreans think about when they think about Libya. It's convenient for them to do that, by the way, but that is the model that they think about. So you've got to distinguish between these two models. The first model is very valid, and I think should be applied to North Korea. They do need to give up their stuff. They do need to give it up front. And we do need to be able to verify, because every agreement we've signed with them in the past, they've violated. And one thing has been constant, and that's the improvement of their capabilities, both their nuclear capabilities and their missile capabilities. And oh, by the way, that's certainly been the case in the past 2 years since the Singapore summit between President Trump and Mr. Kim.
And by the way, folks, just to put a fine point on it, those capabilities are designed and are in place for the purpose of attacking this country. Make no mistake about it. Bob Joseph, when you sort of lay this out, one of the other things that I thought I might just emphasize is back in the day when we worked together, you were responsible in the Office of the Secretary of Defense for the deployment of what were then known as intermediate range nuclear forces, which we ultimately decided not to keep in Europe, having successfully deployed them there in the face of a Soviet threat from SS-20s, as they were called, in favor of a zero option, as it was called, an idea that President Reagan had embraced, which really goes to your point about Libya as well. Get rid of all of this stuff, which, among other things, you know, theoretically eliminates a threat. But it also, Bob, and I want you to talk a little bit about this, it also gives you a much clearer picture in the event that the other party decides to cheat, decides that they're going to have some capability, having said they'd given it up. Talk about the zero option, talk about the zero capabilities in Libya, and how that contrasts with the various other arms control deals, which have always left in place capabilities, and which we've seen cheating take place, but it's always a bit more difficult to make the case that it is cheating, that it is clear-cut violation of commitments, and therefore a basis upon which we must act in response.
Well, I think in the case of INF, it was definitely to our advantage in terms of our ability to verify and monitor to have the zero option. Because if you saw any indication of development or deployment of this type of capability, you could pursue it knowing it was a violation. If you had left forces in place, it would be much more difficult to distinguish what is allowed versus what is prohibited. The same applies, of course, with Libya. If they give it all up, then you're at a greater advantage in terms of monitoring. Let me give you just one example of that, and it relates to Libya. When I was at the negotiating table, again, in the secret negotiations, I didn't have any backup talking points. I didn't have any fallback positions, none of that. Okay. I was just told, don't screw it up by the president when I went over. Okay. And I'm sitting at the table and it just occurs to me when we're composing a statement that the Libyans are to provide, stating that they had a nuclear weapons program and they're giving it up, that the word abandonment, we're going to abandon our nuclear weapons program. This is a Libyan statement. And it just occurred to me that, you know, they could abandon it by just putting it in the closet and a few years later, open up that closet and say, we're going to have a peaceful nuclear program just like the Iranians do. And it was for that reason that I insisted right at the table that we're going to send, you know, our folks over, we're going to gather everything up and we're going to bring it back. And they agreed because, going back to our earlier conversation, Gaddafi thought he was next on the target list.
It does make the point, Bob. And just to come back to this, when we look at what is the legacy of the Obama abandonment of that relationship with Gaddafi, and I have no love for Gaddafi, don't get me wrong, but what you were able to engineer was not simply the end of an important and potentially quite dangerous proliferation program in Libya, but it also helped transform Gaddafi from a lunatic sponsor of terrorists to someone who was rather assiduously helping us combat them. And yet the Obama administration decided, in the interest of, I guess, promoting the Muslim Brotherhood, to liquidate Gaddafi and take down his regime. And the rest is an absolute disaster, not just for the Libyan people, but of course the migration of such other weapons as Gaddafi had throughout Africa and elsewhere, and the ongoing turmoil and instability with the Turks now in the mix. I mean, Bob, this just must make you sick to see what's been brought about. We'll have to talk more about it on the other side of the break, but I just wanted to set that up because this is one of those places where not only did you have really a breakthrough in arms control that really mattered, but its benefits were squandered by the most short-sighted and, I believe, malfeasant effort to curry favor with, well, Sharia supremacists that was a characteristic of the Obama-Biden years. We'll talk more with Bob Joseph about that, and we'll get more into North Korea, Iran, and China on the other side. Very short break with Undersecretary of State Bob Joseph, now at the National Institute for Public Policy, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to our fourth and final installment of a really very important conversation with one of the successful practitioners of arms control. That's a very small universe I can point to as far as I'm concerned. His name is Robert Joseph. He has served in a whole host of important positions in the U.S. government, including finishing up as an Undersecretary of State during the George W. Bush administration. He is now with the National Institute for Public Policy and the Missouri State University as a professor. Mr. Ambassador, just a quick final word on Libya before we turn to other topics.
Sure. Like you, Frank, I have no love for Mr. Gaddafi. He is, after all, to put the bomb on Pan Am 103, and let's never forget who we were dealing with. Also, on the Obama administration, they made non-proliferation the number one national security priority. You saw this in their nuclear posture review. You saw it in their arms control positions. And it is nothing but ironic that the Obama administrations, were the one that created the second model. If you give up your WMD, you get dead in a ditch. There couldn't be anything more ironic than that, and counterproductive.
So let's turn to another kind of arms control model that we've been pursuing, I think, with very little success for decades now. You've been involved in various capacities, usually as a voice of reason and conscience, an anchor to windward. But the latest product of successive arms control negotiations with first the Soviet Union and now with the Russian Federation is the so-called New START agreement. There's a lot of evidence that the Russians have been cheating on it, and yet they're now saying they want to continue it, re-up it, if you will. There's negotiations underway or trying to get underway to that end, I guess. Bob, what are your thoughts on New START and where we are at the moment and where we're likely to go?
Frank, I testified for the Foreign Relations Committee, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, against New START in 2010. Part of my argument was verification and monitoring, which are wholly inadequate in the treaty. And again, we're dealing with a country that has violated every agreement that it has signed in this area. Okay, so it's not like you don't need effective verification. You absolutely must have it. But beyond verification was the basic context of the treaty. We went down and Russia went up under the treaty. I mean, it was just a bad, fatally flawed treaty. Okay, but it was ratified for you. And it is now in effect until next February. The Russians very much want it to be extended. No surprise there. And that might tell you something, that they really want it, and they want it badly. The Trump administration has not yet taken a position on that, but they have said that in any new agreement, in a follow-on agreement, or any extended New START, we have to have all nuclear weapons included, which I think is absolutely right, because under the New START treaty, it's only strategic, so-called strategic weapons that are included. The non-strategic, of which we have a couple hundred, and the Russians have thousands, are excluded. I don't know. You tell me the difference between a non-strategic and a strategic nuclear weapon when one gets off. They're all strategic, but you know, the critics say, well, the Russians will never agree. In fact, I had a conversation with Sergei Kislyak once in which I said, Sergei, you know, is there any way you will ever agree to negotiate on non-strategic? He looked at me and he said, why should we? You gave all yours up. You eliminated all yours. And the same is true with China. I think the Trump administration's position that China has to be included in any future arms control agreement is also right. Do I think the Chinese will accept? No, probably not. But that just means that there may not be an arms control solution to the current situation, to the current national security requirements.
Well, Bob, I would just argue that the practice of arms control, with, again, the notable exception of the Libyan deal, has mostly been a non-solution to the problem anyway. It's been a fig leaf. It's been a means by which we could assure ourselves that, you know, somehow we were doing something about a real threat when, in practice, we really weren't. The anti-ballistic missile treaty that we talked about earlier being just a case in point. But just to stay with this this issue of China, Bob, because one of the things that I've been really vexed by, and I assume you are as well, is this whole idea that somehow we could safely be reducing our nuclear deterrent capabilities. We could be safely entering into these arms control arrangements, even unverifiable ones with the Russians, without any regard to the fact that the Chinese are and have been increasingly a growing danger to the United States with their nuclear capabilities. Talk a little bit about that and the inadvisability of pretending otherwise.
Okay, but let me first say, in general, I agree with your assessment of sort of arms control practice. But I did support INF. I think it was a close call. I know you were on the other side of the of that one.
And it was subsequently violated, and we have now withdrawn from it, just
right.
Saying.
Yep, absolutely, as we should have, because the Russians violated it. And I also was in favor of START II, which was an agreement that eliminated heavy ICBMs. These are these large Russian multi-warheaded ICBMs, but there, Russia never accepted START II, never implemented START II, which also probably tells you something.
And by the way, they're back in the heavy missile business, as I understand it.
You know, they very much so. Modernization, new heavy missiles. I think they have, last count, 22. I may be wrong on that number, but it's in that general, different strategic modernization programs. What we're doing is modernizing our triad, our heavy bomber capability through, you know, through a new bomber as well as through the long-range standoff missile. We've got a new ICBM, perhaps in the future. We're undertaking, you know, the ground-based strategic deterrent program. And we've got the Columbia-class SSBMs, the submarines, a new class of submarines. So we are modernizing ours, but it's the same triad as we've had for decades. The Russians and the Chinese are pursuing very aggressive modernization across the board in the nuclear field, much more so than we are. And in China's case, it clearly is to challenge us. It's to hold our cities hostage so that they can implement their grand strategy. This is the, you know, this is Xi's vision of China as the number one world power. And you see this today in the South China Sea. You see it elsewhere, where they're challenging us economically and militarily, and their design is clear, and a strong nuclear component is absolutely essential to the Chinese design. And we've got to be able to respond to that with effective defenses as well as capable offenses. One of the benefits of getting out of the INF treaty is that we hopefully will be able to deploy INF missiles to that region. And if you look at the Chinese missile force, I'm told 95% of their ballistic missile force is of the INF range. We've got to be able to respond to that. And arms control is not part of the solution here.
Bob, we're going to run out of time before we run out of things to talk with you about. But just a quick last point on this. I have really been struck, just as an indicator of the seriousness of the Chinese, and I fear it's to have a capability that is far beyond what used to be called counter-value capacities to attack our cities. They certainly have that in spades, I think. It's really building the counter-force capability that would enable them to, you know, attack us decisively against our nuclear forces as well, that I think is also in the mix. When you look at 3,000 miles of hardened underground tunnels that they've put into place to conceal as well as deploy their missile forces, many of their missile forces, I think it's anybody's guess how many they have, what character they are, where they are, of course, but also the exact capability that they may now have to decisively attack this country using nuclear forces. This is a topic to which I hope we can return with you, Mr. Secretary. This is, you know, part of the present danger, China. I'm very proud to say you are a member of our committee on the present danger, China, and we value tremendously both your past service to our country, Bob Joseph, as well as that you are continuing to render at the National Institute for Public Policy in Missouri State, and of course with us at the Committee on the Present Danger, China. I hope you'll come back to us again, sir, soon. In the meantime, stay well. God bless you. And I hope the rest of you will join us again soon as well. Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.